Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Feminism for the 99% by Cinzia Aruza, Tithi Bhattacharya, and Nancy Fraser. Narrated by Callie Bollier. A Manifesto. A Fork in the Road. In the spring of 2018, Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg told the world that we would be a lot better off if half of all countries and companies were run by women and half of all homes were run by men, and that we shouldn't be satisfied until we reach that goal. A leading exponent of corporate feminism, Sandberg had already made a name and a buck for herself by urging women managers to lean in at the company boardroom. As former chief of staff to U.S. Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, the man who deregulated Wall Street, she had no qualms about counseling women that success won through toughness in the business world was the royal road to gender equality. That same spring, a militant feminist strike shut down Spain. Joined by more than 5 million marchers, organizers of the 24-hour Huelga Feminista called for a society free of sexist oppression, exploitation, and violence, for rebellion and a struggle against the alliance of the patriarchy and capitalism that wants us to be obedient, submissive, and quiet. As the sun set over Madrid and Barcelona, the feminist strikers announced to the world, "On March 8, we cross our arms, interrupting all productive and reproductive activity," declaring they would not accept worse working conditions nor being paid less than men for the same work. These two voices represent opposing paths for the feminist movement. On the one hand, Sandberg and her ilk see feminism as a handmaiden of capitalism. They want a world where the task of managing exploitation in the workplace and oppression in the social whole is shared equally by ruling class men and women. This is a remarkable vision of equal opportunity domination, one that asks ordinary people, in the name of feminism, to be grateful that it is a woman, not a man, who busts their union, orders a drone to kill their parent, or locks their child in a cage at the border. In sharp contrast to Sandberg's liberal feminism, the organizers of the Huelga Feminista insist on ending capitalism, the system that generates the boss, produces national borders, and manufactures the drones that guard them. Faced with these two visions of feminism, we find ourselves at a fork in the road, and our choice bears extraordinary consequences for humankind. One path leads to a scorched planet where human life is immiserated to the point of unrecognizability, if, indeed, it remains possible at all. The other points to the sort of world that has always figured centrally in humanity's most exalted dreams— a just world whose wealth and natural resources are shared by all and where equality and freedom are premises, not aspirations. The contrast could not be starker. But what makes the choice pressing for us now is the absence of any viable middle way. We owe the dearth of alternatives to neoliberalism, that exceptionally predatory, financialized form of capitalism that has held sway across the globe for the last 40 years. Having poisoned the atmosphere, mocked every pretense of democratic rule, stretched our social capacities to their breaking point, and worsened living conditions generally for the vast majority, this iteration of capitalism has raised the stakes for every social struggle, transforming sober efforts to win modest reforms into pitched battles for survival. Under such conditions, the time for fence-sitting is past, and feminists must take a stand. Will we continue to pursue equal opportunity domination while the planet burns, Or will we reimagine gender justice in an anti-capitalist form, one that leads beyond the present crisis to a new society? This manifesto is a brief for the second path, a course we deem both necessary and feasible. An anti-capitalist feminism has become thinkable today, in part because the credibility of political elites is collapsing worldwide. The casualties include not only the center-left and center-right parties that promoted neoliberalism, now despised remnants of their former selves, but also their Sandberg-style corporate feminist allies, whose progressive veneer has lost its shine. Liberal feminism met its Waterloo in the U.S. presidential election of 2016, when the much-ballyhooed candidacy of Hillary Clinton failed to excite women voters. And for a good reason. Clinton personified the deepening disconnect between elite women's ascension to high office and improvements in the lives of the vast majority. Clinton's defeat is our wake-up call. Exposing the bankruptcy of liberal feminism, it has created an opening for a challenge to it from the left. In the vacuum produced by liberalism's decline, we have a chance to build another feminism, a feminism with a different definition of what counts as a feminist issue, a different class orientation, and a different ethos, one that is radical and transformative. This manifesto is our effort to promote that other feminism. We write not to sketch an imagined utopia, but to mark out the road that must be traveled to reach a just society. We aim to explain why feminists should choose the road of feminist strikes, why we must unite with other anti-capitalist and anti-systemic movements, and why our movement must become a feminism for the 99%. Only in this way, by connecting with anti-racists, environmentalists, and labor and migrant rights activists, can feminism rise to the challenge of our times. By decisively rejecting lean-in dogma and the feminism of the 1%, our feminism can become a beacon of hope for everyone else. What gives us the courage to embark on this project now is the new wave of militant feminist activism. This is not the corporate feminism that has proved so disastrous for working women and is now hemorrhaging credibility, nor is it the microcredit feminism that claims to empower women of the global South by lending them tiny sums of money. Rather, what gives us hope are the international feminist and women's strikes of 2017 and 2018. It is these strikes and the increasingly coordinated movements that are developing around them that first inspired and now embody a feminism for the 99%. Thesis 1. A new feminist wave is reinventing the strike. The recent feminist strike movement began in Poland in October of 2016, when more than 100,000 women staged walkouts and marches to oppose the country's ban on abortion. By the end of the month, an upwelling of radical refusal had already crossed the ocean to Argentina, where striking women met the heinous murder of Lucia Perez with the militant cry, "Ni una menos!" Soon it spread to Italy, Spain, Brazil, Turkey, Peru, the United States, Mexico, Chile, and dozens of other countries. From its origins in the streets, the movement then surged through workplaces and schools, eventually engulfing the high-flying worlds of show business, media, and politics. For the last 2 years, its slogans have resonated powerfully across the globe. Hashtag Nosotras Paramos. Hashtag We Strike. Hashtag Vivas Nos Quidermos. Hashtag Ni Una Menos. Hashtag Time's Up. Hashtag Feminism for the 99. At first a ripple, then a wave, it has become a massive tide. A new global feminist movement that may gain sufficient force to disrupt existing alliances and redraw the political map. What had been a series of nationally based actions became a transnational movement on March 8, 2017, when organizers around the globe decided to strike together. With this bold stroke, they repoliticized International Women's Day, brushing aside the tacky baubles of depoliticization, brunches, mimosas, and Hallmark cards. The strikers have revived the day's all but forgotten historical roots in working class and socialist feminism. Their actions evoke the spirit of early 20th century working class women's mobilization. Paradigmatically, the strikes and mass demonstrations, led mostly by immigrant and Jewish women in the United States, which inspired U.S. socialists to organize the first National Women's Day, and German socialists Louise Zeitz and Clara Zetkin to call for an International Working Women's Day. Reanimating the militant spirit, the feminist strikes of today are reclaiming our roots in historic struggles for workers' rights and social justice. Uniting women separated by oceans, mountains, and continents, as well as by borders, barbed wire fences, and walls, they give new meaning to the slogan, "Solidarity is our weapon." Breaking through the isolation of domestic and symbolic walls, the strikes demonstrate the enormous political potential of women's power, the power of those whose paid and unpaid work sustains the world. But that is not all. This burgeoning movement has invented new ways to strike and infuse the strike form itself with a new kind of politics. By coupling the withdrawal of labor with marches, demonstrations, small business closures, blockades, and boycotts, the movement is replenishing the repertoire of strike actions, once large but dramatically shrunk by a decades-long neoliberal offensive. At the same time, this new wave is democratizing strikes and expanding their scope, above all, by broadening the very idea of what counts as labor. Refusing to limit that category to waged work, women's strike activism is also withdrawing housework, sex, and smiles. By making visible the indispensable role played by gendered, unpaid work in capitalist society, it draws attention to activities from which capital benefits, but for which it does not pay. And with respect to paid work, too, the strikers take an expansive view of what counts as a labor issue. Far from focusing only on wages and hours, they are also targeting sexual harassment and assault, barriers to reproductive justice, and curbs on the right to strike. As a result, the new feminist wave has the potential to overcome the stubborn and divisive opposition between identity politics and class politics. Disclosing the unity of workplace and private life, it refuses to limit its struggles to those spaces. And by redefining what counts as work and who counts as a worker, it rejects capitalism's structural undervaluation of women's labor, both paid and unpaid. All told, women's strike feminism anticipates the possibility of a new, unprecedented phase of class struggle. Feminist, internationalist, environmentalist, and anti-racist. This intervention is perfectly timed. Women's strike militancy has erupted at a moment when once powerful trade unions centered in manufacturing have been severely weakened. To reinvigorate class struggle, activists have turned to another arena: the neoliberal assault on healthcare, education, pensions, and housing. In targeting this other prong of capital's four-decade attack on working and middle-class living conditions, they have trained their sights on the labor and services that are needed to sustain human beings and social communities. It is here, in the sphere of social reproduction that we now find many of the most militant strikes and fightbacks. From the strike wave of teachers in the United States, to the struggle against water privatization in Ireland, to the strikes of Dalit sanitation workers in India, all led and powered by women, workers are revolting against capital's assault on social reproduction. Although not formally affiliated with the international women's strike movement, these strikes have much in common with it. They, too, valorize the work that is necessary to reproduce our lives while opposing its exploitation. They, too, combine wage and workplace demands with demands for increased public spending on social services. In countries such as Argentina, Spain, and Italy, moreover, women's strike feminism has attracted broad support from forces opposing austerity. Not only women and gender nonconforming people, but also men have joined the movement's massive demonstrations against the defunding of schools, healthcare, housing, transport, and environmental protections. Through their opposition to finance capital's assault on these public goods, feminist strikes are thus becoming the catalyst and model for broad-based efforts to defend our communities. All told, the new wave of militant feminist activism is rediscovering the idea of the impossible, demanding both bread and roses. The bread that decades of neoliberalism have taken from our tables, but also the beauty that nourishes our spirit through the exhilaration of rebellion. Thesis 2. Liberal feminism is bankrupt. It's time to get over it. The mainstream media continues to equate feminism, as such, with liberal feminism. But far from providing the solution, liberal feminism is part of the problem. Centered in the global north among the professional managerial stratum, it is focused on leaning in and cracking the glass ceiling. Dedicated to enabling a smattering of privileged women to climb the corporate ladder and the ranks of the military, it propounds a market-centered view of equality that dovetails perfectly with the prevailing corporate enthusiasm for diversity. Although it condemns discrimination and advocates freedom of choice, liberal feminism steadfastly refuses to address the socioeconomic constraints that make freedom and empowerment impossible for the large majority of women. Its real aim is not equality, but meritocracy. Rather than seeking to abolish social hierarchy, it aims to diversify it, empowering talented women to rise to the top. In treating women simply as an underrepresented group, its proponents seek to ensure that a few privileged souls can attain positions and pay on a par with the men of their own class. By definition, the principal beneficiaries are those who already possess considerable social, cultural, and economic advantages. Everyone else remains stuck in the basement. Fully compatible with ballooning inequality, liberal feminism outsources oppression. It permits professional managerial women to lean in precisely by enabling them to lean on the poorly paid migrant women to whom they subcontract their caregiving and housework. Insensitive to class and race, it links our cause with elitism and individualism. Projecting feminism as a standalone movement, it associates us with policies that harm the majority and cuts us off from struggles that oppose those policies. In short, liberal feminism gives feminism a bad name. Liberal feminism's ethos converges not only with corporate mores, but also with supposedly transgressive currents of neoliberal culture. Its love affair with individual advancement equally permeates the world of social media celebrity, which also confuses feminism with the ascent of individual women. In that world, feminism risks becoming a trendy hashtag and a vehicle of self-promotion, deployed less to liberate the many than to elevate the few. In general, then, liberal feminism supplies the perfect alibi for neoliberalism. Cloaking regressive policies in an aura of emancipation, it enables the forces supporting global capital to portray themselves as progressive. Allied with global finance in the United States, while providing cover for Islamophobia in Europe, this is the feminism of the female power holders. The corporate gurus who preach lean in, the femocrats who push structural adjustment and microcredit on the global South, and the professional politicians in pantsuits who collect six-figure fees for speeches to Wall Street. Our answer to lean in feminism is kick back feminism. We have no interest in breaking the glass ceiling while leaving the vast majority to clean up the shards. Far from celebrating women CEOs who occupy corner offices, we want to get rid of CEOs and corner offices. Thesis 3. We need an anti-capitalist feminism, a feminism for the 99%. The feminism we have in mind recognizes that it must respond to a crisis of epical proportions. Plummeting living standards and looming ecological disaster, rampaging wars and intensified dispossession, mass migrations met with barbed wire, emboldened racism and xenophobia, and the reversal of hard-won rights, both social and political. We aspire to meet these challenges, eschewing half-measures. The feminism we envision aims to tackle the capitalist roots of metastasizing barbarism. Refusing to sacrifice the well-being of the many in order to protect the freedom of the few, it champions the needs and rights of the many, of poor and working-class women, of racialized and migrant women, of queer, trans, and disabled women, of women encouraged to see themselves as middle-class, even as capital exploits them. But that is not all. This feminism does not limit itself to women's issues as they are traditionally defined. Standing for all who are exploited, dominated, and oppressed, it aims to become a source of hope for the whole of humanity. That is why we call it a feminism for the 99%. Inspired by the new wave of women's strikes, feminism for the 99% is emerging from the crucible of practical experience, as informed by theoretical reflection. As neoliberalism reshapes gender oppression before our eyes, we see that the only way that women and gender nonconforming people can actualize the rights they have on paper or might still win is by transforming the underlying social system that hollows out rights. By itself, legal abortion does little for poor or working-class women who have neither the means to pay for it nor access to clinics that provide it. Rather, reproductive justice requires free, universal, not-for-profit health care, as well as the end of racist, eugenicist practices in the medical profession. Likewise, for poor and working-class women, wage equality can mean only equality in misery unless it comes with jobs that pay a generous living wage, with substantive, actionable labor rights, and with a new organization of house and care work. Then, too, laws criminalizing gender violence are a cruel hoax if they turn a blind eye to the structural sexism and racism of criminal justice systems, leaving intact police brutality, mass incarceration, deportation threats, military interventions, and harassment and abuse in the workplace. Finally, legal emancipation remains an empty shell if it does not include public services, social housing, and funding to ensure that women can leave domestic and workplace violence. In these ways and more, Feminism for the 99% seeks profound, far-reaching social transformation. That, in a nutshell, is why it cannot be a separatist movement. We propose, rather, to join with every movement that fights for the 99%, whether by struggling for environmental justice, free, high-quality education, generous public services, low-cost housing, labor rights, free universal health care, or a world without racism or war. It is only by allying with such movements that we gain the power and vision to dismantle the social relations and the institutions that oppress us. Feminism for the 99% embraces class struggle and the fight against institutional racism. It centers the concerns of working-class women of all stripes, whether racialized, migrant, or white, cis, trans, or gender nonconforming, housewives, or sex workers, paid by the hour, the week, the month, or not at all, unemployed or precarious, young or old. Staunchly internationalist, it is firmly opposed to imperialism and war. Feminism for the 99% is not only anti-neoliberal, but also anti-capitalist. Thesis 4. What we are living through is a crisis of society as a whole, and its root cause is capitalism. For mainstream observers, 2007 to 2008 marked the beginning of the worst financial crisis since the 1930s. Although correct as far as it goes, that understanding of the present crisis is still too narrow. What we are living through is a crisis of society as a whole. By no means restricted to the precincts of finance, it is simultaneously a crisis of economy, ecology, politics, and care. A general crisis of an entire form of social organization, it is at bottom a crisis of capitalism, and in particular, of the viciously predatory form of capitalism we inhabit today, globalizing, financialized, neoliberal. Capitalism generates such crises periodically, and for reasons that are not accidental. Not only does this system live by exploiting wage labor, it also free rides on nature, public goods, and the unwaged work that reproduces human beings and communities. Driven by relentless pursuit of unlimited profit, capital expands by helping itself to all of those things without paying for their replacement, except where it is forced to do so. Primed by its very logic to degrade nature, instrumentalize public powers, and commandeer unwaged care work, capital periodically destabilizes the very conditions that it, and the rest of us, rely upon to survive. Crisis is hardwired into its DNA. Today's crisis of capitalism is especially severe. 4 decades of neoliberalism have driven down wages, weakened labor rights, ravaged the environment, and usurped the energies available to sustain families and communities, all while spreading the tentacles of finance across the social fabric. No wonder, then, that masses of people throughout the world are now saying, basta. Open to thinking outside the box, they are rejecting established political parties and neoliberal common sense about free market competition, trickle-down economics, labor market flexibility, and unsustainable debt. The result is a gaping vacuum of leadership and organization, and a growing sense that something must give. Feminism for the 99% is among the social forces that have leapt into this breach. We do not, however, command the terrain. Rather, we share the stage with many bad actors. Upstart right-wing movements everywhere promise to improve the lot of families of the right ethnicity, nationality, and religion by ending free trade, curtailing immigration, and restricting the rights of women, people of color, and LGBTQ+ people. Meanwhile, on the other side, dominant currents of the progressive resistance advance an equally unsavory agenda. In their efforts to restore the status quo ante, partisans of global finance hope to convince feminists, anti-racists, and environmentalists.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?